apocalypse actually means the unveiling, but I think it's the end of the world as we know it. An unveiling of truth.
The Mayan calendar reset. It wasn't too long in advance of the first halving.
Symbology of 12/21, 2012.
Bitcoin represents everything we didn't understand about money, everything we didn't understand about networks, everything we didn't understand about cryptography. It's like one of these complex rabbit hole systems that catalyzes a lot of seeking, a lot of learning.
Welcome back to the Bitcoin Nova. Today I have Red Tail Hawk with me, and my friend OG Bring Facts suggested this guest for me and sent me a couple of his podcasts, which I'd listened to and they were fascinating. So I'm super excited to have him here today to discuss some of these topics, how they connect to Bitcoin. So thank you. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me. Facts is a great guy. He and I met in summer of 2020 online, learning how to do technical analysis of price charts. You know, there wasn't a lot to do in 2020 other than stay home, maybe attend to your garden, maybe do some home improvement projects, do some learning, that kind of thing. And it was that stepbrothers moment. Did we just become best friends? Yep. You want to go do karate in the garage? Yep.
So did you meet in real life too then?
Yes, we've gone on a trip together. I've stayed over at his place a number of times just because he lives like 40 minutes away. And, you know, you go out to a bar or whatever, you don't want to drive home while you're inebriated or whatever. And yeah, he's always been an extremely kind and gracious and hospitable guy. I mean, he's got his hard ass side, but he's a good guy.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I see that in him too. Like he can let it out. He can speak facts, bring facts. You know, that's why I love his name, because he just says it like it is. But he does it from a place of truth. You know, he's not trying to, it's not really about ego. It's just kind of truth. You know, I feel like he's a really genuine guy. So yeah, you guys met in 2020. And was it like an X meet or something? Or how did you guys meet online? Was it like a place that you meet Bitcoiners typically?
It was a Discord server that was associated with a YouTube channel, and the YouTube channel was basically all about chart analysis.
Okay.
And that YouTuber, I have no idea if he's still active or not, but he had a technical analysis academy that he sold as a product, and Fax and I both patronized that academy and learned what he had to offer there. You know, it was basically a bunch of videos on a website. So as far as like interaction goes, there wasn't really much. And so the Discord server was a useful way of connecting with other people who were interested in Bitcoin and in general price charts. I mean, gold, other cryptocurrencies, stocks, whatever. It's all the same technical analysis with obvious differences from asset class to asset class. But
do you feel when you started in 2020 doing all that chart analysis, because that's where I began, I was definitely deep into the charts, watching the charts every day. And I feel like I've changed so much since being in Bitcoin that I don't mess with other cryptos or anything. It's Bitcoin only for me, but I know that it's fun to kind of look at the charts and kind of predict what they're going to do, but I also don't really care. I'm just stacking sats. So how do you feel you've changed since 2020? Do you think that you do that more or less?
I would say that I probably pay less attention to charts than I did when I was learning how to read them. I know that people are like, oh, you can never sell your Bitcoin or whatever. But I mean, to be fair, sometimes people, myself included, have fiat denominated debts. And, you know, in order to extricate myself from those debts, I'm going to have to pay some amount of fiat to clear that. And it seems like at a certain point, I might want to dip into my Bitcoin holdings to secure my debt freedom. Bitcoin is freedom in a lot of ways. And so if I can use it to extricate myself from debts, then it would be beneficial to, I don't know, it's kind of like being in the cockpit of an airplane and you took off, but you've never really landed before. And so it's useful to sort of go figure out the instrumentation and the controls so that you can kind of read things and figure out how to land the plane if you need to do so. It's also helpful for perhaps orange pilling. You know, normies and no coiners, they're oftentimes mostly interested in number go up. So being able to offer somewhat realistic insights as to where we're at in the cycles and stuff is maybe useful. Although, frankly, I always caveat those predictions with, yeah, but this time could be different because of X, Y, or Z reasons, and we could be about to enter a super cycle. I have no idea what's going to happen next, but I just give them my best guess based on what I've accumulated in terms of knowledge.
Yeah, because when people know you're in it, that's how they understand it. They want to know what's going on as far as the markets. You want them to understand where we're at. And it's a really interesting time to be living through with these changes that are going on. I truly just feel like, and you probably would understand this more than some, probably based on all the knowledge that you've gathered. When people talk about the fourth turning and the idea that we're in for this massive change, I feel like when people use the word apocalypse, it actually means the unveiling. I don't know if you've heard that.
Right.
So you know that. Okay, cool. Because I'm like, I'm saying it to the right person at least. So I'm thinking of it like when people talk about the word apocalypse, they think mass destruction and the end of the world type of thing. But I think it's the end of the world as we know it. And I think that, like that song, but yeah, the end of the world as we know it. And I think that this apocalypse is really an unveiling of truth. And we're seeing that a lot now when it comes to these Epstein files and these evil people that are in our world. The onion layers are starting to peel back and we're starting to see things come out and be revealed. And when people start to lose faith in the dollar and the global reserve currency, it will naturally move into a money that you don't have to trust someone else. So you need to go into something that is transparent and it's an unveiling of things like Bitcoin is transparency. So I don't know how you feel about that. Secure your seed phrase with Microseed. Discreet, durable, the ultimate security. Use code XSTACY for 5% off your order.
Yeah, I mean, I wrote about half a dozen articles for Love is Bitcoin in late 2023 and maybe the first half of 2024. And the April 2024 article, which was coincidental intentionally with the halving, was called Revolution is Bitcoin. And I took a page out of Ron Paul's playbook and I turned the EVOL that's in Revolution, made it spell love by reversing the direction of the L and the E in there. But it was all about cycles and how Bitcoin plays into various cyclical frameworks, including the fourth turning, the, you know, was it Moore's Law with microprocessors or whatever? I forget exactly what it is. I have to go look up my own article.
Is that the whatever can happen will happen sort of thing?
Whichever one I'm thinking about, it's the one where like the number of like microprocessors per chip doubles every 18 months or something like that.
The S-curve adoption, like the, because I think Moore's Law would be like that exponentially growing technology.
Right. And then I also touched on like, the Mayan calendar reset in 2012. And that happened, I don't know, like it wasn't too long in advance of the first halving. I mean, the first halving was in what, November 20th of 2012. So fast forward like 3 weeks basically, and you're looking at the Mayan long count resetting.
You must have read my mind, because when I brought up the apocalypse thing, part of my PTSD about hearing of the apocalypse was because my father, and he would always bring up the Mayan calendar. And he would always tell me it's December 21st of 2012. And I was pregnant with my son. He was due in 2011. And I'm like, Dad, stop trying to tell me the whole world is going to end, you know, right after I have my first kid. This is insane. I was like so scared. I was scared leading up to it, not really believing it. But I was also thinking this looming date was above me. You know, I kept thinking about it, you know, and it kind of was in the back of my mind all the time because he just loved to be like a doomer. You know, he just wanted to, I'm like, can you just pretend you don't know this information? Like, should I not have kids? But then, you know, it came and went and nothing happened. But I have thought about that recently when I thought about the unveiling and I thought about the word apocalypse and what it means. And then I connected that to Bitcoin and its first halving. So I almost felt like because people talk about like the Mayan calendar is about measuring time. It's a calendar. And then, you know, we have time and then we have Bitcoin, which is a new clock, you know. So then you think about almost like the, even though Bitcoin didn't come out the day the Mayan calendar was supposed to end, but like you said, it was the halving. It's almost like the first halving was like the clock start. It's like almost like that's the clock starting to move. And even though it wasn't perfect to the day, I'm so glad you brought that up because I thought I was the only person thinking about that thing.
Yeah, I mean, the Mayan long count tracks the precession of the Earth's axis, which wobbles, right? It's not constantly straight and then the Earth is constantly moving around, rotating. There's a slight wobble to it and it processes one full revolution of that wobble over roughly 25,772 years. A year, I mean, 3 weeks, 3 years on the order of 25,772. That's a pretty small amount of discrepancy there compared to the big picture. So I'm thinking that, yeah, Bitcoin is one of the big factors that is meant to shape the new world. And you keyed in on something important. I don't think the end of the world was what they were talking about. I entirely agree. It was the end of the world as we know it, and for a variety of reasons.
Wow, that's so amazing. I'm so glad because these are thoughts that I have and I need to talk to with somebody, and I love to share with other people. So this is great that we're getting to put this information out there, because I don't know very many people who studied the Mayan calendar or just, you know, want to talk about that. But what you said also about the amount of discrepancy being very small and how it's so close. The other thing is the symbology of using that specific date, 12/21/2012, is there's 21 million coins. So there's a lot of twos and ones there. Interesting, yeah. Right? Like to use that specific date with twos and ones around the time that the first Bitcoin halving happens. I always say I don't believe in coincidences. So I just think that's crazy.
Yeah, I'm also glad you invoked the timekeeping change that we as Bitcoiners have adopted using block heights as a way of keeping time. And this all fits in well with actually another article I wrote in, it was like my December 23/January 24 article, not to be confused with Gigi's article, Bitcoin is Time. I made all of my articles were Something is Bitcoin because it was written for Love is Bitcoin's website. So I'm just going to play off of that theme. But this one was called Time is Bitcoin. And in that article, I explored various timekeeping conventions that we've developed as humans. You know, the winter solstice, which is 12/21, is one of those timekeeping dates. And that's how people would keep time, identify that was midwinter. The equinox in spring was, okay, now it's time for planting season. Midsummer was a gauge for the summer solstice. The autumnal equinox was a trigger for, you know, we better be harvesting right now because it's going to be winter soon and we need to make sure the larder is well stocked so that we can survive through it. There's no driving up the street to the local Walmart to get more supplies back then, right? You pretty much had to be prepared to weather whatever winter had to offer. So I think that the timekeeping conventions sort of matched up there quite well with the you know, 210,000th block occurring just, you know, a little more than 21 days in advance of 12/21/2012.
Yeah, that's really crazy to think about that stuff. And, you know, just realizing that, you know, the whole timekeeping thing, you know, and oh God, I had a really good point right now. Something about the time, something, oh my God. My brain is the worst sometimes. Like, I have all these interesting thoughts, but unless I can't remember them. But if it comes up, I'll tell you. But it has something to do with that timekeeping. You know, it's just really wild to think about the equinox. You know, you talked about, you know, December 21st being the equinox. That's the date they chose, right? And then it also is 21 million coins. Like, why was 21 million the number? Maybe Satoshi followed the Mayan calendar. Maybe he just wanted to make that be the unveiling. Maybe, you know, who knows? Maybe if he studied that, what was the reason for that specific date and time? And also, I think this was my thought, was why not in 2009 when Bitcoin started running during the Genesis block? Why was it after the first halving? So maybe because, you know, we have minutes to a clock, but then we have the hours. So maybe like the halvings are the hours of the Bitcoin clock, because it's much bigger than really, like, you know, initially that supply just came out, half the supply just came out, and then like clockwork, it starts to release more. So during the halving is that clock starts, because it started to go automatically with the schedule.
Yeah, I don't know, obviously, who Satoshi was or what the entirety of Satoshi's motivations were. We obviously have forum posts and whatnot, emails exchanged between early Bitcoiner cypherpunks. I have run across some things in my sort of more esoteric research that may suggest that development of Bitcoin did have, you know, sort of higher origins, so to speak.
Really?
Not necessarily, you know, from the other side or anything, but as we were moving into, you know, this, the end of the world as we know it, into this new world, I can imagine that the sort of the string pullers in the background may have done something to catalyze a shift that would impact the whole population in positive ways. Because
interesting,
when you first learn about Bitcoin, generally speaking, most of us, Bitcoin represents everything we didn't understand about money, everything we didn't understand about networks, everything we didn't understand about cryptography. It's like one of these incredibly complex rabbit hole systems that encourages or catalyzes a lot of seeking, a lot of learning, right? They say you're, you know, if you're a real Bitcoiner, you've done, you know, 5 or 10,000 hours of podcast consumption, right? Learning about this stuff, hearing people talk about sort of the more technical side, hearing people talk about the philosophical side, et cetera. So it wouldn't shock me if there's a higher, I guess, agenda at play. And so Satoshi helped manifest that.
Okay. Not higher agenda, not like higher, you know. So what specifically do you mean by higher agenda?
So like,
what do you think?
In my research, I've found certain source materials that are really hard to ignore. Like, people with a closed mind are the architects and wardens of their own mental prisons, and they're going to be dismissive of a lot of things that, you know, prejudicially so. But as I've studied some of these materials, I've found them to link up in so many ways with other things that it becomes very difficult to write them off as, well, this is fictional, this is nonsense, this is made up or whatever. Brandon Quittam offered me a word recently that I really fell in love with. It was consilience, which is essentially when you have multiple independent sources that are all pointing at the same conclusion. It's not necessarily like an ironclad, watertight, airtight conclusion, you know, deductive reasoning kind of a thing. It's just more of a, like, okay, I've got 5 or 8 or 13 different sources that are all pointing at the same conclusion here. Maybe I should give this source some more weight in terms of being valid than I might otherwise have had I not noticed all of those sort of synchronicities or parallels.
That goes back to my belief that there are no coincidences, because most of the time people think it's a crazy coincidence that all these things are similar, but maybe not.
And that's been a huge part of kind of my more esoteric research, is noticing, like, for example, today, the Bitcoiner who goes by the name Context with a K on X and on Nostr posted something about a Greek word, Kyrios, which is K-Y-R-I-O-S, or yeah, sometimes spelled K-U-R-I-O-S sometimes.
Yeah, in Greek, the church, it's like Kyria Eleison. It's like, it's for priest or for sir. You know, it means sir.
I think it means, according to his post, it means master or lord. So that would be in alignment with the idea of sir. It's an honorific. And I think eleison that you mentioned, it's basically a phrase meant to indicate like, Lord have mercy. But
yes, thinking, because I didn't know the exact, I know I hear it all the time in church, and sometimes it just sounds like nonsense to me because it's not like real Greek people speaking. It sounds really chanty, you know, but I hear that all the time. And it is during a part where it seems like it's like, Lord have mercy, you know, so that's like what they're saying, you know.
The point he made was that while, you know, your academic linguists, your philologists, your etymologists are likely to disagree with this, it's difficult to ignore the fact that Kyrios, K-U-R-I-O-S, and curious,
yeah,
like the idea of being curious about learning things, are incredibly closely related. You kind of have to read the tea leaves and take things with a grain of salt and realize that, you know, the propagation of terms, of words, of language from one person to the next is not always as clean cut as we would think that it might be. I mean, take for example the word meter, right? This is something that I used to teach my students when I was teaching math and critical thinking at a learning center, like a supplemental learning center. Imagine a Scottish, I guess, tutor roaming the hillside, you know, looking for nobility who would be willing to offer him room and board in exchange for teaching their children. And this Scottish teacher is teaching the child about metering things or measuring things. I don't know which word came first, but, you know, if you think about it, S and T are extremely similar sounds, especially if you make the T sound and then extend it, it becomes an S. So if you think about a Scottish person and he's teaching you about how to measure the distance from here to there, which word did I say? Meter? Measure? I mean, the E on the end is silent. They start with M and end in R. They've got vowels in the middle, and the T and the S are basically the same sound. So words kind of morph when they shift from one place to another. Like maybe on that day, the child who was learning didn't think to ask the teacher how to spell that word. And so they just kind of internalize it. Okay, mecher. And then later on, maybe they're teaching their younger sibling or something who wasn't born yet, and the sibling asks, well, how do you spell that? And like, well, actually, I don't know. Let's sound it out and come up with something. And boom, one word has just forked into two words. So I think going back to like curios and curious, to me, it makes a lot of sense because, I mean, every tradition in some way, shape or form kind of talks about how the ultimate goal of everyone's path is to reunite with like the one infinite creator. And very few believers would object to the idea that the creator is all-knowing. And so in order to reunite with an entity that is all-knowing, it stands to reason that we should accumulate a lot of knowledge and wisdom and understanding. These are all virtuous traits. These are all divine traits. Certainly, again, very few believers would object to the idea that the creator is all wise, all understanding, all powerful, all merciful, all victorious, all glorious, right? So the acquisition of knowledge, what is the spark that lights that fire, if not curiosity? So for someone to be dubbed, you know, Lord or Master, but using the word curious makes a lot of sense to me, because that to me makes me think of a person who is naturally curious and therefore sought out knowledge. And that means actually abiding the golden rule, which again, every tradition has some variant of this. my favorite articulation came, I think, unintentionally from Rudolf Steiner, who basically said that all you have to do is see things from the perspective of the other. Because, like, I might love Reese's peanut butter cups. You might be allergic to peanuts. So even though I might think that Reese's peanut butter cups are the greatest gift you could possibly give me, for me to show up with a truckload of Reese's peanut butter cups at your house, you're not necessarily going to be all that excited. You're not going to feel loved. You're not going to feel seen by that gesture. It's about what you want, right? And so it's about looking at things from the perspective of others. And that's, I think, something that a lot of Bitcoiners have picked up on as being the most effective method of orange pilling is, you know, trying to meet the no-coiner where they're at. Like I said, I mentioned Brandon Quittam earlier. If I'm talking to, you know, an eco-hippie or a gardener, a permaculturalist, a farmer, a horticulturalist, somebody who's really into plants or mycelium or whatever, I'm going to pitch them Brandon Quittam's work because they're going to relate to that.
Right.
If they're a gun guy, if they're a 2A, a Second Amendment advocate, if they're ex-military or ex-law enforcement or currently in either of those, whatever, I'm probably going to feed them Jason Lowry's Soft War because that's going to mesh with how their mind already works. It's a matter of finding out what makes a person tick and then meeting them where they're at. And that was something that we did at that learning center where I worked. We primarily focused on math and critical thinking. We did do some work with language, but I would say, you know, 85%+ of our students were there for the math and critical thinking. And I think that what we would do is we would neurologically profile each of our students and then use that profile to do our very best to plan individually for each child. If this child is more of a visual learner and this other child is more of an auditory slash kinesthetic, maybe they're a dancer and anytime they hear a song, their body just has to move. So that's like their dominant circuitry is both auditory and their body, kinesthetic, tactile, right? So breaking kids down into different categories, profiles, archetypes, maybe they have different needs. Like some kids, they'll need completion more than others. They have maybe a stronger need for propriety. So I remember just dropping jaws in one initial diagnostic test for a new student who was going to join our center. The parents had already attended our training seminar, make sure that they were on the same page with us and that, you know, they weren't going to be fighting us tooth and nail every step along the way. So the next step after that seminar was to bring the child in for a diagnostic test. So this was my first exposure to this child. And 5, maybe 10 minutes into this diagnostic test, I noticed that while writing the number 9, the child drew the circle, didn't quite connect it, and then drew the stick, and then advanced on to the next thing that they were going to write. But then sort of a light bulb moment happened where they realized that they didn't actually complete the circle for the 9. And so they went back with their pencil and filled that little gap in.
Yeah, because it bothered them.
Yeah, they had a need for completion and a need for propriety. Some kids are totally fine with, you know, slopping down chicken scratch and just flying through a workbook. Well, those two kids, I'm going to plan for them very differently from one another because I know that the kid who has that need for completion, that need for propriety, they're going to spend a lot more time and attention doing their work for me. And so it's going to take longer. And the kid who doesn't have that need for completion is going to just slop down answers. They might all be right, and that's fine, but they're going to fly through a full workbook in the same amount of time that it will take the other kid to fly through half of a workbook, I suppose grind through half of a workbook. So I'm going to assign the one kid, you know, half of that workbook as their daily homework, and I'm going to assign the other kid the full workbook because that is going to fill out a full work session. if you ever sit down in like a meeting with people face to face, like for example, at a conference table in a conference room, just note their posture in the beginning is probably going to be leaning forward, leaning into the event that's going on. They might have a pencil in hand. They might have their hands on their keyboard if they're taking notes on a laptop. But people start dropping like flies as the meeting progresses. You know, the posture shifts back. That's an indication of them being done with what they're doing and literally pulling away. Their body is pulling away from it. They might, you know, pull their phone out of their pocket and sneak a peek at what notifications they've gotten since the meeting started. They might look out the window of the conference room at the squirrels fighting with the birds over the seeds that fell out of the bird feeder or something. I mean, it's there's an absorption window that everyone has. And our goal at that learning center was to assign the right amount of work to each student on a daily basis so that they wouldn't burn out. It's kind of like when you cook food, you don't cook it for 3 hours just because you can. You cook it for the amount of time that it needs. And you do that every day because you need to eat every day. Likewise, every time you go to sleep at night, your short-term memory scoop turns around and dumps into the long-term memory when you go through your sleep cycles. So it's a good idea to sort of make a deposit into that long-term memory storage every single day, because then you're making a deposit and you get like the compounding benefits from that, right? The more you know, the more connections you see between things.
Because maybe that means I don't get enough sleep, because I don't think I make enough deposits into my long-term storage. So that's a really interesting idea. But the thing that you were saying about, you know, the students and everything, is that, I want to know if about your work, if that's what you currently do, but also just thinking about the fact of being observant about these kids and doing these studies. It's part of what makes you understand what's happening in the world right now with finance and these changes that are going on in the world too. Being able to be observant, because some people are just too distracted by the things that aren't the root cause of a problem. And I think when you see different learning patterns, you're looking for, you know, how to best help them with this goal, you know, so you're not just trying to shove it in their feet. You know what I mean? You're actually like, I think that helps with understanding the world, being observant.
Absolutely. I mean, observation is necessary for understanding. You can't understand anything unless you've already received some kind of sensory input, whether it's someone teaching you or making visual observations or whatever. Very important.
And then do you do that currently still? Is that what you do for a living?
Right now, I'm transitioning towards my research. I'm reaching out to publishers, you know, giving them samples of the book that I'm working on writing. I'm interested in maybe looking for work in the Bitcoin space. I'm interested in looking for work in the education space. I have been working as an engineer for a contractor for about 15 years. But I just couldn't do that anymore. The culture was not compatible with the me that I have become. And as a result of, you know, Bitcoin, I have enough of a nest egg to where I can give myself that option to punt on my income stream and rely on the stack of sats that I've accumulated in over the years, and try and chase what I think my real mission is.
And that's the other thing that ties back to what you were saying about curiosity, because it's like now that you could follow your passion and you afforded yourself the ability to do that, now you can be even more curious and follow things that make you, you know, that make you happy. And a lot of times that is discovery, you know, and discovering different things about the world and how it works. And going back to even a thought I had about the curiosity aspect and the kudos is the idea that, you know, I don't know how it is in many different religions, but I think it's probably pretty similar. But like the creator, you know, if God or this being, you know, the source, you know, that we would all look to go back to is a creator, which, you know, when you look around you and you see math everywhere, you know, so that's, so math is creation because it's design, you know, mathematics are design. But when you think about the idea in the Bible where it says that, you know, people are in the image of God. So the image of God would mean that you are also creator. So thinking about that other thought that you had about you manifest the world that you want to see. So when you are negative and you don't believe in the future and all these different things, that's the world that you're going to create just from your thoughts, you know, because your thoughts can create your reality. So it's hard for people to believe that. But when you start to realize that your positive thinking can kind of change things around you, you become a creator because you can be curious about what your life could be like and you can follow it. And I don't know. So that's an interesting thought about curiosity / positive thinking, you know?
Yeah, I kind of think about the creator as being, I really like Spinoza's concept of the creator as being literally everything, all matter, all consciousness. So you are made out of God, and your consciousness is a sort of firewalled stream of God's consciousness. And God is essentially using your life as a high-tech aperture, like a peephole, but with more bells and whistles than just being purely visual, right? And, you know, to me, if I try to, and this is ambitious, I guess, but if I try to, you know, golden rule, take the perspective of the creator based on the descriptions of the creator that many traditions have offered, that, you know, God is all-knowing, like all-powerful, etc. It seems like omniscience, knowing everything, would be boring.
Yeah.
Because there's no discovery. There's no novelty. You already know it all. But like, if you then choose to explode yourself into a gajillion little, you know, waveforms that create an interference pattern called the universe, and matter starts to form, and then eventually matter evolves and life forms evolve, and eventually life forms become capable of receiving, you know, like spirit at a certain point, you have, you know, these little C creators that are out there endowed with free will. I don't think creation was a one-time event. I'm not sold on the Big Bang thing. I think the universe is infinite, and that God is basically exploring him/herself through limited finite perspective through each of us, because it's just way more interesting that way. I mean, it's kind of like Darwin Awards are kind of interesting. It's like, let's watch all the stupid stuff that people come up with to do and see how, you know, what sort of novelty arises from that.
Right. Maybe it reminds me too of the idea of how it's not fun if everything's perfect. Like when I think about a scary thunderstorm or if there's a tornado warning, and I have three kids and my kids are between 10 and 14, and you know, I would think that they're like terrified, but they're actually like, oh, this is actually kind of scary, but it's kind of fun. You know, and they're actually excited that they get to go in the basement and get some flashlights and lose power sometimes. They're like, oh my gosh, that's, you know, they're actually like having fun because they're not thinking it's real danger, you know, but at the same time, a little bit of chaos can be fun, you know? So I think that, like you said, if there's this one source that's all knowing and all, you know, knowing everything life could be or will ever be, and then, but it's never, let's say it's when you have different dimensions, the 3D world is where we're at now. But when you have all these different dimensions where you can't experience it in an organic form, how we are on Earth, you can't experience despair, anger, you know, loss, pain, all these things in a perfect world. So you're like, even though it might stink, you're kind of like, well, what would it be like? You know, so maybe this place when people wonder or say, I've heard people say before that there is no God if bad things are happening, which is crazy to think about. But also it's sort of like a discovery of human nature and being human and the trials and tribulations and things that the interactions with other people and what happens on this earth is something that maybe if a soul has never experienced pain or suffering, then they were like just curious to see what that's like, because they obviously could understand it in this mental kind of brain state, but maybe not physical, you know, like what would it be like, you know? So I don't know. I just think it's almost like a learning, like kind of like joining a video game for the time that we're here and this is our avatar. It's kind of interesting.
The problem of evil is one of the difficult ones that philosophers and theologians have wrestled with for millennia, I'm sure. My best rationale for it is that, free will is sacrosanct. Without free will, there is no creation. There are no acts of creation that occur that were not predicated upon free will. And so the Creator respects the free will of each of us. And so I think that when we encounter acts of evil, which I prefer to define evil as like being hyper polarized towards service to the self, like some amount of service to the self is baked in. We have to take care of number one first of all. Like if you're on an airplane, you're supposed to put your mask on first before you help your kids, right? You're not going to be able to help them if you've already, bit it, right? If you've already bit the dust. But I think that the existence of evil or, self-serving entities in this world, it's an opportunity. It's a catalyst for us to be of service to those who maybe are victimized by them.
I love thinking about it that way because, yeah, then it gives people a chance to show their humanity when there's such an opposite, dark side to humans. There's such a good side and helpful and loving side that can reach out and get someone out of that bad situation. So it's an opportunity for people to see what they're capable of as far as being a hero to somebody else, So it's an empowering thing. And I also don't believe that because you're here and people commit evil acts, then it's like, oh, now that's forgiven. I do feel like there's this universal karma sort of soul stain that gets on, Like, I don't think you just get away with being an evil person on this earth. I don't think that that's how it works.
I agree. I mean, there is God's infinite mercy and whatnot, but part of that applies to that free will thing. So if somebody wants to polarize towards service to others or service to the self, that's their choice. They will, when they sort of, graduate from this existence to sort of the next grade of universe school for souls, there is going to be a grouping that occurs where birds of a feather flock together. I heard a priest offer an articulation of the difference between heaven and hell a long time ago, and it always resonated with me. As I've been studying, doing my esoteric research for the last 3+ years, this one source that I mentioned earlier that found to be incredibly resonant and harmonious and whatnot with so many things basically described it the same way, is that the story the priest told was everyone in heaven and everyone in hell are super glued in their chair around an infinite round table, and everyone has like a 5-foot long spoon super glued to their hand, and they've got a bowl sitting in front of them on the table that's super glued in place, and it's a never-ending bowl. It just automatically refills, and what it's full of is the most delicious tasting, smelling, the most nutritious stew that you could possibly imagine, right? And everyone in hell is trying to manipulate their arm and get, 5 foot of distance and get a little bit of stew on their spoon and throw it up and try to catch it in their mouth, and it's getting all over them, and they got flies and gnats and stuff getting all over them because they're making a mess. But in heaven, everyone is feeding their neighbor.
I love this way of thinking because it reminds you of how when people have that human nature thing, greed, and it's like when you're greedy, you never have enough and you're always thirsting for more and it's never going to fulfill you, So this greedy world, when people are obsessed with things and accumulation and thinking that objects will make you happy, you have this thirst for something that it's never going to quench you. So that's kind of like that hell that, but then when people, it almost seems like a lot of people that finally find Bitcoin, they start to move away from, you know, consumerism and not caring so much about the stuff around them. And they're more fulfilled in knowing that they're going to see a better future and everyone's going to prosper and help others around them. It's like, that seems like those two sides to me.
I've been doing a bunch of Bitcoin Army spaces on X over the last week. And in one of them, I was talking about, actually, I think multiple of them, I talked about one of my favorite bands is Wookiefoot. And it's a little strange to some people, but the fans of Wookiefoot are a lot like me in terms of being interested in like esoteric spiritual subjects. And frankly, a lot of us are somewhat of a hippie, right? And so one of the songs of theirs that gets the most animated response from the crowd at their concerts is a song called Just Visiting. And I mean, it's about essentially like the idea that you'll never see a hearse with a trailer hitch, right? So you can't take it with you. So earthlings, don't keep your treasures here on earth, right? That's, I think, very much in line with what you were just saying there. And that begs another like related topic of conversation. John Vallis has talked about this a lot. I actually found out that he has a portmanteau, a combination of two words that is perfectly resonant with how I have thought about this. As a person with Greek heritage, you might be familiar with the term metanoia. It's like a full changing of heart, of mind, where you were looking over here your whole life and all of a sudden you're looking here now, right?
I'm thinking of loia. Is that part of loia? That's like logic?
Metanoia is, I'm not sure what it actually breaks down into. I probably need to look into that. But I remember learning about this in high school theology classes. I remember my freshman theology teacher just drilled this into our head. It was on every weekly quiz
and I'm
the whole year.
In Greek, but I'm not like, I don't have an extensive vocabulary in Greek. So that's probably why I'm not like understanding some of the stuff. But yeah, I'd love to look into that. So what is it?
So like when a person sort of gets bit by the orange pill bug or whatever and realizes, so if this thing is like this nascent asset class and it's sitting at what point, whatever, $1.2 trillion right now, you know, pundits are estimating that it has the potential to eat $100 trillion worth of monetary premiums in the real estate market, in the gold market, in the art market, et cetera, et cetera. There's a lot of room for growth right now. I'm basically picking up pennies that are eventually going to be worth dollars. People start to realize, okay, well then I should stop buying worthless garbage and I should try and dump everything I've got into this Bitcoin thing. And if I'm going to, I guess, withhold things from myself and, you know, impose self-austerity measures in terms of my own consumption, especially during the first cycle or two or three that I'm hodling, it would be nice to take on a few extra years at the end of life by doing 600 push-ups a day, like what Fax is doing, or by developing a jogging habit, or eliminating seed oils, or starting a more robust supplementation regimen. So it's not just about changing your mental diet. It's about changing your physical diet, your physical habits. And a lot of times when the mind and body are moving in positive directions, so too does the spirit. And so a lot of Bitcoiners wind up either turning to some form of spirituality or religion, or they turn back to some form of spirituality or religion. And that's the Bitcoin metanoia is, in a nutshell, it's the realization of what you've gotten yourself into, the likelihood that it's going to bear fruit for you in your lifetime. And, you know, if you eat crap long enough, you can eat caviar for the rest of your life.
Meta would be like later in Greek. Meta.
Okay. Okay.
Word later means like saving it for later, like time preference type idea.
So maybe noia is related to gnosis and knowledge.
Maybe.
And so later knowledge is what causes you to, instead of looking over here, new knowledge has forced you to look over in this direction instead. Maybe that's what it means.
Uh-huh. Well, that's interesting. I don't know why it just hit me right then. But the other thing too, is when you mentioned free will, you know, Bitcoin gives you the choice and the free will, and then you're escaping from that what felt like a prison of need and want and greed, you know, and then you, and also selfishness to wanting to give something to your kids for their future, giving them a better world to grow up in. It's more helping, lending a hand, giving, saving for better, you know. So it's that transparency, that apocalypse, that unveiling, when you have this truth-based money that also is free will, you know. So it's very God-like, creator-like, because it's what the creator would want, for you to be curious about it, to find it, for you to realize your potential or your future could be better. You know, all these different things are curiosity-based things that lead you to Bitcoin. And it just feels like the other way was the, you know, when you think of darkness and light, like fiat is the darkness. It's the veiling. It's the secrecy and the control, and you would think of evil as control and loss of free will and all those things. And, you know, just everything that's hidden in the dark. And then light is good, and light is, you know, you have good and evil, you know, so it's just the unveiling would be the good and the exposing of truth, you know, so you could see, you know, everything. So I just think that's fascinating.
Yeah. Unconditional love is important. And I think a great way of thinking about that is this phrase that I don't remember where I heard it, but society grows great when old people plant trees underneath whose shade they shall never sit. So the idea of, you know, setting up generational wealth for your kids and your kids' kids, even if one does not experience the fruits of one's own sort of wealth accumulation within one's own lifetime, the idea of passing that forward to the next generation is an act of unconditional love. And that's, I think, something that a lot of Bitcoiners have keyed in on. And that's kind of how I feel about my research. There's a lot of philosophers and theologians out there who, you know, they never got any traction. They're a lot like artists, you know, when they were alive, their work was not appreciated. But it was, you know, after they died that their research eventually gained the prominence and the respect that, frankly, it always warranted. But, you know, pearls before swine, right? We're recording this less than a week after the anniversary of Giordano Bruno's death. Was this brilliant philosopher, theologian. I think he was a friar for some time, and he developed all these incredible memory techniques. And like, he actually had audiences with kings, queens, popes, all sorts of high status people in society. But sort of like Galileo, he was, I guess, persecuted by the Inquisition. And for the final 7 or 8 years of his life, he was imprisoned, he was tortured, eventually he was burned at the stake. But, you know, this guy, his thoughts were largely correct. I mean, look at what's happening right now with the UFO and UAP disclosures that are coming out there about aliens and stuff. I mean, Bruno believed that the universe was infinite. There were other worlds that had life on them. He believed that the geocentric model was false and that Copernicus's heliocentric model was more accurate. And by and large, he was vindicated as time wore on. And now there's like a statue of him in the very square in Rome where he was executed. Wow. And he's now viewed as, you know, a champion of science and of speaking truth to power and not backing down. Even if my research doesn't have the splash that I think it has the potential to during my lifetime, I'm okay with that because I'm still going to put it out there. And I know that I've already turned a number of heads who have consumed that research. And if it turns out to be a tree that I planted underneath whose shade I shall never sit, so be it. Maybe the domino effects move forward and I get some good karma points out of that.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I love the good karma point thing too, because you're lending that hand to the future. You're passing down knowledge. You're doing important work that you're documenting that knowledge and spreading it, planting seeds all around, you know, so it's very important work. And just thinking about how, you know, you leave that legacy and how he was, you know, willing to stand up for what he wanted to spread and share and pass on to the future is something that when you hear Bitcoiners say, I'll die on this hill, you know, it's like the persecution that comes with it. It's hard being a Bitcoiner. It's hard understanding this truth, but you are strong enough to stand up for it. And I think so many do, you know, I think there are anyone who goes out there and does what you're doing, you know, putting your research down, sharing how important this is, somebody will see that one day. And it's just, even if it's one person that you help, you lent that hand to somebody through passing that knowledge. So it's rewarding, and it makes you feel like, you know, you can be somebody's hero, you know, and that's what it's about. It's like you come to this earth to find out who you can be. You can create something and you can create better ripple effects, you know, for the future. But when you think about that, the unveiling again, I think that something I was going to say about the persecution or something, but it's just so much of what's happening right now. I mean, it really, I think when you talked about the UFO unveiling, that's another unveiling thing that, you know, it's like, okay, this is supposed to come out, but it's also interesting because of the chaos and the distraction that's happening, you know, to kind of get people's eyes off the Epstein stuff and like, hey, we have aliens now. Yeah, okay, we probably figured there are aliens by now because the universe is vast and it's got to be real. But and it'll be amazing to find that out. That's another unveiling piece of the puzzle that we are going to know about probably eventually, probably soon. But it's just funny how the dark side, you know, when you have the light side of truth and the dark side of manipulation and dishonesty is trying to get you to look over here, you know? So it's like, but by doing that, they're exposing more truth. So it's interesting.
Yeah, I think Bitcoiners are, if we're not Sigmas already when we became Bitcoiners, by virtue of being Bitcoiners, we were forged into Sigmas. Are you familiar with the Sigma personality type?
Well, I know that my Greek name starts with a Sigma, but that's, I think it just means, actually tell me, I don't want to guess.
So like you have your alphas, right? They're at the top of sort of the social hierarchy. They're the most capable. They're winning. They're the CEOs of the Fortune 500 companies. They're the movers and shakers, the leaders, right? And then you have the betas who are kind of, they're pretty competent. They want to be considered as alphas. They're not really alphas, but they're sort of, you know, trying to keep up with the Joneses, right? And then there's all these other sort of wolf pack archetypes. And then off to the side, and I think this is alliterative because off to the side, that hierarchy is, you know, a vertical stack, but off to the side, you have the Sigmas. And Sigma also is alliterative with solo. That's the lone wolf archetype.
I love this.
In order to be a lone wolf, you have to be really competent because living in a pack affords you certain luxuries, a sort of a safety net. You don't have to go kill all of your meals, and like you can sort of draft off of, you know, the other alpha wolves who sort of take down the prey, and you don't have to necessarily be the best at defending yourself because your pack will help defend you and help defend your territory. But if you're going to go solo and be a lone wolf, you have to be essentially alpha level competent.
Wow.
In order to fend for yourself. So I think that when we are on the receiving end of, you know, criticisms and ridicule from outsiders, that, you know, that experience forges the Sigma personality type. And that's why we have, you know, we're honey badger money, right? And honey badgers don't care, right? Like we are confident in our research and our positions. And if you don't get it or don't understand it, we don't necessarily have the time to convince you, like Satoshi said. So we've got a world to change. And we're not necessarily going to be encumbered by the idea of keeping up with the Joneses.
It's so interesting. I was just trying to, I love all of that you said that. Yeah, it's like you're not worrying about trying to convince anybody at this point. You try as much as you can, but it's like you can't do it. Like you're not pulling teeth to do it. You're just trying to do it to people who are willing and accepting this information or who look interested in learning it, because we're not trying to, you know, beat it over your head, you know, really. Like you start off that way, but then you're just kind of like, I'm going to wait for the response, you know. But then it, I love that you said this because it reminds me of the Bitcoin black sheep that me and my husband are, he came up with this idea of the Bitcoin black sheep, and we've been making these designs and, you know, creating merch out of it and stuff. But it's nice because we feel like black sheep a lot. Like we feel like we're outcasts and we totally are okay with it. So we're just, and we try to teach that to our kids because they're all about, you know, when you're in school, they get sad, they come home some days and they're like, oh, you know, I felt left out today, or kids didn't. I'm like, you know what? That's cool. Be yourself, be different. It's hard to teach them that. They have to learn it on their own. They're not going to get it. It takes years before I think you understand this mentality. But it's okay to not fit in. And it's kind of like embrace that. You know what I mean? So I love that you said it's the stigma thing, because I didn't realize that's what it meant, you know?
I kind of wonder how much, I'm sure there are people out there who know more about this than me, but like how much overlap or I guess correlation is there between the Sigma personality type and on the Myers-Briggs, the INTJ and the INTP? Because again, I mentioned Brandon Quittam earlier. He did a Myers-Briggs poll on, I think back when it was called Twitter, of Bitcoiners, and there was a ridiculous overrepresentation of those two personality types.
I know I'm either one of those.
I ride the line between both. So we're both natural Bitcoiners in that regard. Wow. And I want to say that they're not the rarest of the Myers-Briggs archetypes, but I want to say they're not super popular. I think that in general, the feeling types, it's like 80% of people are feelers or something, and maybe 20% are thinkers, kind of a thing. That lines up potentially.
That's interesting. Yeah, I think my husband is the only one of my little group of friends that we were doing that personality type together. He's the only one that felt that came out extroverted from us. Like we're all introverted, which is weird because I do a podcast and I talk to people all the time. But it's because it's something I'm passionate about. You know, I feel like I'm not just out there trying to be starting conversations out of nowhere. He's totally that guy. We're just going out somewhere and he's talking to the waitress about random things. I'm like, how do you do that? You know, you're starting conversations. But yeah, I'm different in that way.
And we have to be different in order to be okay with the idea of going off on some side quest to see what's over there when that's not the main path.
Right.
Like if Sigmas are indeed the rarest sort of wolf pack archetype, and Bitcoiners are, you know, as a community, overrepresented with that personality archetype, again, it makes a lot of sense because, again, Bitcoin is this complex rabbit hole, and that requires seeking information, seeking understanding. People who are worried about how they look with regard to their peers and with respect to the social hierarchy, they are unwilling to let themselves evolve in public and let people see that they are changing their position on things based on newfound information, because they're worried about their ego, they're worried about their pride, they're worried about betraying that I was wrong before and I'm changing my mind now. Because that might make people think, what else were you wrong about? Maybe I should just completely write off your opinion.
Yeah.
Whereas the person who's oriented towards truth seeking and is less worried about ego is going to be like, oh my gosh, this is awesome. I was wrong before, but now I figured out how I was wrong and I don't have to be wrong anymore. I can be correct going forward and I can share this newfound understanding with anyone who wants to hear it. And that I think is a good thing. I mean, that's, you were talking about shade earlier, light and dark. I kind of view going to like the spiritual esoteric side of things that, you know, there's like two ways to sort of find the light. on the positive path and on the negative path, on the service to others path, the positive, the good path, and the service to self, the negative, the evil path. There's two ways to sort of achieve enlightenment. One of the evil paths kind of skips over the love side, right? That's the differentiation mark there. But with all the string pullers in the world engaging in cover-ups and, you know, distorting various traditions so that, you know, they get sort of hijacked and, you know, they were on course, but then they got hijacked and got diverted off course. There's just so much that has been sort of obfuscated from being obvious. And it takes a seeker to really find that. I view it almost like a gardening technique where the gardeners are these sort of shadowy string pullers, and their goal is to try to produce like stocky, thick, badass plants that can push up through the overgrowth that has been allowed to happen. That's the cover-ups, right? That's all the distortions, is the overgrowth in the garden. But if you're just this stout, thick, beefy plant, and you can push up through that overgrowth and find the light. And ideally, if you're, you know, a positively polarized, good, service to others type of plant, you're going to return nutrients to the soil that will benefit the other plants that are around you. And so you'll form like this guild of plants that together grows above the rest of the surrounding canopy. Not just you will find the light, but those who are around you will find the light as well. Whereas the negatively polarized plants, they'll do the opposite of gilding, like the Three Sisters garden that the Native Americans do with corn. And then I think pole beans, they use the corn stalks to as the poles.
Yeah.
And then they use squash to kind of retain moisture, and there's nitrogen fixing that goes on, and they all benefit from each other, and that's a guild. But the opposite of gilding would be like allelopathic plants. And allelopathic plants, you should not plant plant X next to plant Y. They're not going to get along. And so these negatively polarized plants, the way they find the light is by killing off all the other plants around them, by dominating, by taking all the nutrients that they can get from sort of the local soil, and then trying to seep in as much of the light as they can. And they're the ones who move on to what people would call hell, or in the next density or dimension, with all the other people who were self-serving like them. If Earth is dog eat dog, that place is dog eat dog on steroids, full of like Olympic champion dogs, right? And on the other side, the heaven realm, the graduates who go there are all about service to others. And that's why it's all about love and light there.
Yeah, that's so cool. I love that your words get me thinking about more things. And that's what's cool. It's like different ideas sprout other ideas, but it reminds me of how, I don't know if you watch much TV, but, you know, there's like an apocalyptic episode every, you know, week. You know, there's like a new show out that's like about post-apocalyptic world. And you always see these overgrown cities with weeds and trees, and everything is taken over because humans have left and they're no longer there to tend to it. So sometimes I think of, because of Brandon Quintum and the mycelium network, and, you know, the way that the Bitcoin network reminds people of, you know, neural networks and, you know, galaxies and different things. It's just that when you think of nature and a forest and the ecosystem of a forest, and Bitcoin being the network being, you know, growing like a natural thing in the world, it reminds you of the fiat system being these cities. And then as the fiat system starts to crumble, people are fleeing fiat and moving to other things. So they're leaving the cities, and now nature is able to grow, and these trees are sprouting up through the cover-ups and the weeds and all those things that were just kind of there. But now you have actual trees taking over. Now the city doesn't look like a sterile city anymore, like controlled by corporations. It looks like nature, and that's what Bitcoin is. So it just kind of seems like people will flee.
Yeah, I agree. That's and going back to one of my favorite bands, Wookie Foot, has a song that's pretty much about, you know, like, here's to the grass that's growing between the cracks, right? And that's sprouting up and kind of reclaiming the concrete jungle for the real jungle.
That's amazing.
I think that the powers that be in Hollywood have a lot of esoteric knowledge, and I think that they offer us good parallels, analogies, metaphors, ways of thinking about the world that are, from my research, highly aligned with the structure of reality. I mean, so I think that when we're seeing a lot of these sort of apocalypse shows, that's their way of, you know, pointing that, hey, this is what's on the horizon. You know, a recent show I did, you mentioned Kayvon Devani, was about the pole flip subject, which can be a little doomy gloomy, but I don't intend it to be. I think of it kind of like a final boss in a video game. It's an opportunity to try and maybe overcome that or do something good in the face of that. So I'd be shocked if all these billionaires building bunkers in New Zealand or Hawaii or Texas or Colorado aren't in the know on this subject, especially when you realize that multiple books have been written about this that have in some way, shape, or form been classified. I mean, if who's going to be most likely in the know on classified stuff, it's probably the billionaires, right? So
why they're trying to do the multi-planetary.
Yeah, I think the bunkers is one side of it. I think Bezos and Musk doing their sort of SpaceX and other pursuits to get off the planet. That's another way of sort of, you know, like Noah's Ark, right? It's a ship that gets you out of the way of the disaster cycle.
And I know that this will be the last question because we're going to be winding up here. I got to pick up my daughter from school a little bit, but I could talk to you all day. This has been amazing. And we should do it again sometime because it's been awesome. But I do want to ask you before you go about, this is your main topic of interest, the pole shift. This is what you're writing a book about?
It's probably less than, I don't know, right now I would estimate it's maybe 15% mm-hmm. of the pages.
Okay.
Primarily the research is history. Okay, so Bitcoin is, we all know Bitcoiners tend to be anti-war, right? We know that the fiat system enables war. And, you know, Henry Hazlitt's broken window fallacy in Economics in One Lesson, Jason Lowry's soft war. There's all sorts of stuff out there that points at this. Nikola Tesla's problem of increasing energy, the future machine that would remove mankind from the battlefield of kinetic war. What I see bullets and bombs flying around in the name of God right now. And I find that disturbing because, again, every religious tradition has a variation of the golden rule, and divisive dogmatism is completely antithetical to the golden rule. And so while I believe that Bitcoin will do a lot to bring mankind closer to world peace than we've ever been, at least in known history, I don't think that it brings us over the finish line because it's not able to fix people's individual values hierarchies. And so there's going to remain religious extremists who are so wound up in their dogma, in their dogmatic beliefs, that they are willing to misallocate their capital towards religiously motivated violence. And my research has primarily been studying all of these different religious and spiritual traditions, esoteric wisdom traditions, the occult, etc. And what I've found, and a lot of people haven't found this because they don't do that work. They don't do that. They don't go love their neighbors as themselves and go study Hinduism and go study Judaism and go study Islam and go study the old Greek religion.
Blinders on.
Right. It becomes this egotistical, dogmatic thing. And anything outside of the tradition that I'm familiar with, that's just the song of sirens of Satan. That's not loving to think of those people that way. So I've been trying to love all my neighbors and study all of their traditions and look for what's good to be found there. Look for the baby within the bathwater. and they all point at the same things. So my goal is to rug pull the motivations of the religious extremists who would misallocate capital even post hyper Bitcoinization, when it would be economically unwise to do so, by showing the world as best as I can, these are all the ways that these various religious traditions are in alignment with one another. And my message is one of unity and peace and love.
I love that, because I think I've heard someone say, I can't pinpoint who said it, but whether you're praying to one God or I'm praying to another God or someone across the world's praying to a different God, we're all praying to the same being. There's one creator out there. Something created this world and us. You know, and there may be 100 different worlds with 100 other creators, but whatever created us, it was like probably one being or one group of beings or whatever. So whatever it is we think we're praying to, it's all going to the same place.
I agree. And they all emphasize unconditional universal love. Like in Greek, it's agape, right? They all preach wisdom, like philosophia, right?
Yeah.
Love of wisdom.
Right.
And ultimately they all preach surrender or submission to sort of the machinations of the universe.
I've never thought about the word philosophia, but philo is like kiss and sophia is like wisdom. So it's like love, wisdom.
Philo is from philia, which is like the brothers in arms.
Friends.
And friendly love.
Well,
it's the love
words
between.
Come from that. Because yes. It's either friends or it's leaf. Like philo is leaf, or it's phili, which is kiss, you know, so there's like a lot of words that come from that same word. That's interesting.
That's what a lot of my research has been focused on, is words and understanding the way that words progress. Like we talked about curios and curious earlier. You mentioned hero earlier. Hero is the same as Hera, Heracles, Chiron, Charon,
Hera,
chariot, Eros, Valentine's Day, Cupid, right? Like all of these words are related to Chi and Rho. And if you'll notice in a lot of Christian symbolism, there's the Chi and the Rho symbol. You have over across the pond in Egypt, the capital of Egypt is Cairo.
Yeah.
Those are not coincidences.
Right.
All that stuff ties together, mm-hmm. and it just takes a willingness to think something. Yes. And love for your neighbors. And, the idea that there is objective truth. There is subjective truth, but it all feeds to the objective truth in the long run. And it's a matter of taking all those subjective truths and cooking them and distilling out of them that objective truth that there is.
That's amazing. I love that, because now that you're talking about the Kidio, like it's the Gapa, I think, the K and the Ro, like those words. I'm just thinking, like, my mind is going to be going all day today now thinking of other things that I'm connecting it to. So thank you for making my brain more curious, and I hope that this makes some other minds more curious, and maybe we could talk more about the pole shifts next time you join me. And just it's an interesting weave that we made through this conversation, but it's been a lot of fun, and thank you again for joining me.
Thank you very much. It was good to be here.
Thanks. Have a great day. Thank you. That was amazing. Thank you.